This program has many annual events we like to celebrate. We recognise Christmas, Easter, Yom Kippur, Bloom's Day, of course, where we have our Joycean readings, but one of my favourite days is Dershowitz Day, because almost every year we track Alan down to talk about something or other. A couple of years ago it was a reversal of fortune. Then the agony and ecstasy of being a Jew in America when Alan published that fascinating book, Chutzpah, I can never pronounce that correctly. And of course now he's in the eye of the storm, in more ways than one, in that he's a member of the defence team for O.J. Simpson. And before I bring him on, I just want to make a simple point. Australians are looking at America askance and seeing the whole place as an asylum, I think. But we must remember we have had a case like O.J. Simpson, and that was the Lindy Chamberlain case, which was as metaphorical, as symbolic, as complex, which resonated in our psyche every bit as much as the Simpson trial. And I think we all behaved pretty disgracefully during that, so let's not be too patronising when we look at American law. Alan Dershowitz, his clients, Klaus von Bülow, of course, Mike Tyson, Patricia Hearst, Christian Brando, to name but a few, a great liberal lawyer who's got himself into trouble on other occasions for defending the rights of most unpleasant people to freedom of speech. And here he is now, as I said, one of the O.J. Simpson team. Do you feel sometimes, Alan, that you're the only sane person in the asylum?
Not at all. You're absolutely right to be critical of the American legal system. There's much to criticize about it, and I think the O.J. Simpson case will reveal to the world some of the strengths and many of the weaknesses of the American legal system. But Winston Churchill once said about democracy that it is the worst possible system except for all the others. Some people who defend the American legal system, particularly its adversarial nature, say the same thing about our system, and that remains to be seen. I think the world will judge us in part by the fairness of the process and outcome in the O.J. Simpson case.
Don't you regret, however, that your system does allow a media maelstrom? If you were doing this case in Australia, there would be such powerful inhibitions on television, radio, and the press.
No question, no question. In fact, I am at the same time doing a case in England, a much more complex murder case in England. It's going much more quickly, more smoothly. There's no media coverage. Although it's a very prominent case in England, the press simply doesn't report in the way that it does about the Simpson case. But the reason why we have no constraints on the press is because we have a First Amendment to our Constitution which absolutely prohibits the courts from imposing any constraints on the press about anything.
It's like Catch-22, though, isn't it, Alan? It's a powerful catch, that one.
It's a powerful Catch-22, and it makes it more difficult to conduct civilized trials. On the other hand, it has some advantages as well. Even for trials, we would not have gotten Watergate but for the fact that a vigilant press was uncovering what the legal system was trying to cover over. And on many occasions, we've seen the press perform brilliantly. In fact, I think the court of last resort in the United States for convicted defendants who are facing the death penalty, for example, today is the press rather than the judiciary. Our Supreme Court has behaved abysmally when it comes to death row inmates, when it comes to issues of innocence, but the press has kept it as honest as possible by focusing public attention on miscarriages of justice.
Why did you saddle up for this one, Alan?
Well, this is a challenge that no lawyer could turn down. I'm a teacher. That's my primary role. I teach students at Harvard Law School. I taught them today. I write books. I just wrote a novel called The Advocate's Devil, which...
A novel, Alan?
Right, a novel.
My God.
It got a wonderful review in the New York Times, and it's being widely read, and it helps educate the public about the legal system. That one's about a lawyer who initially believes his client is innocent, then learns that he may be guilty and dangerous, but learns it in confidence and can't reveal that, and the moral turmoil the lawyer goes through, it's a thriller.
Alan, just promise me one thing. You won't write a musical.
I'm writing. I'm actually working on an opera. So you'll have to have me back when that's done. But I write novels to educate, and I take cases to educate. And what better opportunity to educate not only the American public, but the world public on the legal system than a case which is being followed for all the wrong reasons around the world? But education often uses the wrong reasons why people are focused on a matter to help teach them.
Yeah, well, it's well argued. You are, of course, immensely unpopular with many people, aren't you, because of the sort of the high-profile cases. You're seen
as a criminal defense lawyer. Has to be immensely unpopular with large segments of the population. Can you imagine ever giving a Nobel Prize for being a criminal lawyer? This man gets a prize for having freed more murderers, rapists, and robbers, having made your streets unsafe. Of course we're unpopular. I mean, our job is to fly in the face of popular conventions, to stand up to mob rule, to basically stand as a barrier between the tyranny of the majority and the rights of individuals. So anybody who wants to win popularity contests doesn't become a criminal defense lawyer.
Yeah, but you do, but Alan, you do the opposite. Alan, you do the opposite. You seek out people who are so on the nose that no one else will touch them with a barge pole. I mean, Kahani, people like this that you've defended. I'm not criticizing it. I think it's terrific.
That's my job, because I'm a professor with tenure, which is exactly the opposite of being a politician. I'm paid to be controversial. I'm paid to be unpopular. I'm paid to take stands that people who have to run for office can't afford to take. So if I won't take the most unpopular cases, how can I teach my students to do so?
Okay, public perception. Let's get down to tours here. The public perception is that a celebrity can get off easier, not only because they can afford to hire dazzling talents like your own, but because America is celebrity mad.
Well, tell that to Mike Tyson, who's finishing his third year in prison for a crime he didn't commit, a crime in which the legal process was fixed against him. The prosecutor picked the trial judge, who was a former rape prosecutor herself, excluded evidence of innocence. Being a celebrity means the system is different. It means sometimes you get breaks and sometimes you have disadvantages. Patricia Hearst, for example, never ever would have even been indicted had she been a nobody. Who ever heard of somebody being indicted after she was kidnapped, after she was raped in the closet, after she was treated horribly for weeks, brainwashed, and then made to go along with a crime? Normally she would have been given immunity and told to testify against her colleagues. But instead, because she was the daughter of the most prominent newspaper magnate in America, she was prosecuted. So being a celebrity makes the system different. Sometimes it helps, and sometimes it hurts.
And sometimes you're a target for crucifixion, and sometimes for repeated resurrections. Okay, now, I would have thought the first problem with a criminal lawyer is to exude credibly that they believe utterly and loyally in client innocence.
No. Lawyers are not supposed to put their own personal views on trial. That's why Marsha Clark was properly rebuked yesterday by the judge for wearing an angel pin into the courtroom. She is not supposed to say to the jury, either by symbol or by words, "I believe this defendant to be guilty," and I'm not supposed to say to the jury, either by deed or by words, that I believe this defendant to be innocent, at least until after the trial is concluded. The job of an advocate is to present the evidence. The job of the advocate is to advocate. But we're not witnesses. We weren't there. Why should anybody believe either the prosecutor or the defense attorney's opinion of guilt or innocence? That's why I don't express my opinions about guilt or innocence, at least until after the trial is concluded.
Of course, that's what made Reversal of Fortune, I refer to the book rather than the movie, so intriguing, because you were personally so revulsed by von Bülow, by what you imagined, with some evidence, I think, to be his anti-Semitism, his elitism, his, you know, all that, and yet you defended him so ably.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's very important for lawyers to put their own personal views aside. I think surgeons do the same thing. We don't, as surgeons, have to be in love with our patients. We have to do the best possible job we can. And lawyers are surgeons of the law.
But at least the patient is under anesthetic, Alan.
Saying, the patients are conscious, so you have to deal with them. I have a lawyer friend, Edward Bennett Williams, who was a great lawyer. He's dead now a few years, who used to, before he took on a case, say to the client, "Look, I'm your surgeon, and my partner here, he's your anesthesiologist. And if you take me as your lawyer, he's going to put you to sleep, and you will not say a word. You will not be involved. I will make all the decisions for you as if you were under surgery. And when it's all over, you will either thank me or curse me, but that's the only involvement I essentially want to have with you." And there are some clients who want to be treated that way. I could never treat a client that way, but it works for some.
Mm. The thing I find interesting, we're getting glimpses of this. We're not being bombarded 24 hours a day. It's not being CNN'd into Australia.
Boy, are you lucky.
We're lucky. But we get a glimpse of the tactics, and they seem to me to be enormously legalistic rather than adversarial, in the sense that it's the inadmissible evidence routine.
Both sides are doing that. We want to get in evidence involving the police officer, Officer Furman's history of racism and history of discrimination against blacks. The state wants to keep that out. They want to get in evidence that O.J. Simpson was rude to his wife and called her a fat pig when she was pregnant. Our argument is, if the jury hears that, as they have, they will want to convict him without regard to whether he is guilty of the murder. They will decide he's a bad man. They want to get in evidence of a dream he allegedly dreamed. We say that's fantasy, not reality. So yes, a lot of the issues in the case are about editing the film. The film of life needs an editor when it comes to the courtroom. And it's interesting because many jurors think that life unfolds like drama, and they believe in Chekhov's notion that when you hang a gun on the wall in the first act, you had better use it by the third act, so that when they hear that he may have been rude to his wife or even struck her in the first act, and then she's murdered in the second act, the canons of drama require them to conclude that he must have been the murderer. But the canons of life are very different. Life unfolds with coincidences, mystery, uncertainty, and it's very important to persuade juries that the rules that apply to Walt Disney fantasies, where dreams come true, don't necessarily apply in real life, where dreams do not come true.
Alan, you talk as much like a novelist these days as you do as
a
lawyer.
I've been writing novels lately, so.
Yeah. It's interesting that to hear the Chekhov is on the defense team along with you. He's OJ's well served, isn't he?
Now, if you can only get Dostoevsky, we'd be in great shape.
But of course, a lot of the battle is not taking place in the courtroom, where you are carefully, both sides, carefully snipping the film of life. It seems to, the case seems to be being tried in the wider world, on CNN, in the National Enquirer, everywhere.
That's the educational aspect of the case, and it's very important that the public be not only watching the case, but also being educated about it. Now, you ask the average person on the street what the exclusionary rule is. 5 years ago, they couldn't have told you. Today, they can tell you. They can give you their opinion as to what style of cross-examination is more effective for which kinds of witnesses. They can talk about a whole range of issues. Now, of course, by next year, they'll forget it all, but still, it's an important educational function that's being performed.
I remember when we talked about chutzpah, I was quite astonished with the line you took. Here you are, one of the most best-known Americans, immensely successful, tenured at Harvard, greatly admired, and yet you wrote in chutzpah that the Jew in America is still in limbo, is still alienated, is not accepted by WASP society. And yet, to the outside, of course, it is America rather than Israel that is the triumphant state for the Jew.
Mm-hmm.
You're very sensitive on racial issues. How much of a racial trial is this one?
Well, I hope it's not much of a racial trial. We don't know what the motive of the crime was because we don't know who committed the crime, so we don't know whether it was a racial murder. It doesn't look like it was. O.J. Simpson and his wife were of different races, but that was never an issue of contention between them. The case is being tried in Los Angeles, a city which has been torn by racial strife. The arresting officer has a history of having made racist remarks, left the Marines because of racism, tried to leave the Los Angeles Police Department.
He wouldn't be on his own in the LAPD on that, though, would he, Alan?
Wouldn't be what?
He wouldn't be on his own in the LAPD on that issue, would he?
Well, he would not be on his own in the LAPD, and we know that the LAPD has a history, as many police departments in the United States do, of lying and perjury in terms of search and seizure and those kinds of issues. So inevitably, the issue of race will probably come up, but I don't think it will be determined by the racial composition of the jury, because I think that whites in Los Angeles will be as deeply offended as blacks with the racism reflected by some of the police in this case, and they will take that into account in assessing the credibility. But this case should be determined on the basis of the scientific evidence, on the basis of the forensics. The trouble is the prosecution has turned it from a murder case, from a whodunit on the night of June 12, 1994, to a debate over a 17-year marriage, which obviously was quite rocky and had some good and bad parts. And it's much harder to try a marriage than it is to try a murder.
I accept your argument about education, but you're also, all of you, it seems to me, in the entertainment business as well.
Well, entertainment and education are very hard to separate. I teach classes every day at Harvard Law School to 150 of the best and brightest students, and I use humor all the time. I teach for 2 consecutive hours. I have to keep my students' mind engaged. When I lecture to academic audiences, I use humor. I try my best to keep my lectures lively and engaging. So there is a line, a fuzzy line between education and entertainment. Obviously, the key is to keep it substantive and to make sure that essentially the message is one that will help educate, though the means of bringing the message might very well be humor or literary quality. You know, we talked about Chekhov and Dostoevsky. I'm not obviously comparing myself to any great writers, but nobody would remember the great messages of Dostoevsky and Tolstoy and Chekhov unless they also had a capacity to entertain. And so I don't, if you were to say to me, as a teacher, I'm also an entertainer, I would say thank you very much. I appreciate the compliment.
Are you aware of the Lindy Chamberlain case?
Of course. We followed it very closely.
You can see parallels, can you not, between that and O.J. Simpson?
I can, right? I actually wrote an introduction to a reprint of the book that was published in the United States. And so I'm very familiar with the case. And yes, there are striking similarities. I think you put it very well in the introduction that in some respects, both cases go to the heart and soul of the identity of each of our countries. In fact, every generation or so, there's a case that goes to the essence of national identity. In our country, it may have been the Rosenberg case, the communist spies.
Yes, that was a great one. Yeah.
Right, the Lindbergh kidnapping in the 1930s, the Watergate case in the 1970s, and surely it's the O.J. Simpson case, raising the two core cutting-edge issues of the 1990s, the use of scientific evidence like DNA and the whole issue of spousal abuse, which are major issues today in the United States, even aside from the Simpson case. So there should be no surprise of the national fascination. The thing that surprises me is the international fascination. Even though it's muted in your country, nobody ever heard of O.J. Simpson in your country before this happened.
We saw him being a mediocre actor in a couple of rotten films.
Mediocre actor in lousy movies, but you didn't know him as an athlete because American football is not an international sport, unlike boxing or basketball.
Praise the Lord for that, right?
Yeah, and so I was in Israel, in fact, when the O.J. Simpson case broke, and the peace process was full steam, and yet the O.J. Simpson case took the peace process off the front page, and nobody even knew who O.J. Simpson was. The fascination in Israel was Americans seem so mesmerized by the case, we're going to watch the Americans watch the O.J. Simpson case. That was the fascination.
I think that's right. I think that's a fair comment. Even the House of Windsor is deeply grateful. Because it's taken the heat off them.
Look, well, I think so is Bill Clinton. I think Bill Clinton's commented at one press conference that with Watergate and some of his problems, he was very pleased that over the summer, national attention was focused on a courtroom in L.A.
I take it that there's a virtual reality Dershowitz who's down in Los Angeles at the moment doing this case, while the real one's up in Harvard.
I am virtually in Los Angeles as we speak. What I do is every day I turn on the television set when the trial is on. I have my fax machine and my Nexus and Lexus machines, which are computerized retrieval systems. I watch the case. I immediately see a problem. I fax my objection to the court. We call them virtual objections or cyberspace objections. You can literally see my fax in the TV screen coming up in back of Bob Shapiro's desk. He reaches for it, hands it over to one of the other lawyers, and they file the objection or file the memorandum. So we are virtually in the courtroom. I think this is the wave of the future.
Am I talking to the real Dershowitz or to the virtual reality cyberspace one?
This is a tape recording. Now, I remember once I was on TV, and a friend of mine who's a very, very bright professor walked in, and he came into the living room where we were watching me on TV, and he said, "Alan, is that live or taped?" And I responded by saying that it was live on TV and that I was taped. But virtual presence in the courtroom is, I think, going to be something that more and more lawyers are going to use. It's very efficient. It's very cost-effective. It doesn't require you to travel long distances. It doesn't require you to sit in the courtroom and waste an enormous amount of time. Instead of having six or seven lawyers in the courtroom, I think in the future in complex cases, there will be one or two lawyers in the courtroom and the rest of them sitting in their offices or at home having virtual input.
Okay, I know you're busy. But it seems to me that fuzzy line you were describing is now as wide and broad and deep as one of the worst West Coast fogs. And it concerns me that most Americans can no longer work out what is real as opposed to what is virtual, and this in the whole area of celebrity, this whole...
Well, that's particularly true in a case like O.J. Simpson, where I think when people watch that famous slow motion chase. Everybody had seen O.J. Simpson in other chases on TV. It was hard to understand what was reality and what was fiction. Well, let me tell you, I speak to O.J. every day, and for him, this is reality. I mean, this is a very, very painful reality. And when you get to speak to the defendant, there is just no doubt about what's virtual and what's entertainment and what's reality. This is the reality of the rest of his life.
Alan, many years ago, I made a very notorious Australian film called The Adventures of Barry McKenzie, which is based on a comic strip, and we were going to do a sequel in America, and we decided to have as the centerpiece a slow motion car chase. We thought that'd be the most wonderful parodic statement.
Yeah. Oh,
and then there it was, and I was looking at it too.
Stolen from you.
It is the most rapturous moment, I think, of popular culture, that chase. Okay, look, I have to ask you a couple of things going back into your past. Does Klaus von Bülow still take you to lunch?
Takes me to dinner now. I was in London just a couple of months ago, and he arranged a dinner party for me, which was amazing. It was the most elegant dinner party I've been at in many, many years. It included some of the great names in London society, elegant people, former justices of the High Court, former this and that, and diplomats, and dukes, and royalty, and they all came for Klaus von Bülow. So in London, he is certainly well-received. The verdict of the jury, the second jury, is accepted, and he's a part of society.
In Reversal of Fortune, you made the point that once you cease to be a mega-celebrity, you no longer got the good tables. And more recently, John Mortimer, who, like you, is a very good writer on law, in his case, English law,
says, a wonderful writer, yeah.
Says that nobody is forgotten as absolutely and immediately as the criminal lawyer that gets you off. No one ever speaks to him again.
I have an experience. It's funny, he and I have exactly the same perception. I had a person who I got off. He had been a Harvard Law School graduate, and he had gotten 10 years, I think, in prison for a serious fraud, and I got him off on appeal, and then he never served any time, and it was a wonderful result. And one day I saw him with a younger woman walking down the street, and I thought I would go and say hello to him, and I saw him quickly whisk the woman across the street to avoid encountering me. And I said to myself initially, that's the gratitude I get for saving this man 10 years of his life. And of course I realized that if he introduced his friend to me, he would have to explain how he knows a criminal lawyer. And probably this friend didn't know about his problem. And so he completely avoided any contact with me.
Well, that's why I always, when I say I'm going to talk to Alan Dershowitz, I say I'm talking to Dershowitz, the novelist, or Dershowitz,
right,
the opera libretto writer. You see, then it's okay.
I have an office in my home is because there are some people who don't want to even come to see me for fear of the suspicion that they're in deep trouble.
Dershowitz, old chap, I'm afraid we've got to terminate because the line is now breaking up. Thanks very much for that. We shall watch your faxes with bated breath. And when the opera's coming out, We'll talk again.
It's a retirement project, when I have a little bit more leisure, but I promise to come back on your show and sing you an aria.
Thank you, Alan Dershowitz.